listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
If you are now or have ever been a pet owner, the chances are that you've lost that pet through runaway, accident, illness, or death. And the chances are also great that you never completely mourned that pet's loss, largely because nobody gave you effective help in knowing how to do that. Until now. Today, we're talking about grief recovery for pet loss with Russell Friedman. Whether your pet was a cat, a horse, a bird, a dog, or even a spider, you're in the right place now to learn how to grieve the loss of your pet so you can remember all about your pet with happiness and without renewing grief. We welcome your questions and comments on the chat at both Blog Talk Radio and EmotionalPro.com. And you can also call in toll-free, 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. You're listening to Full Power Living, and we are helping the world to realize the power and importance of human emotions and what wonderful things happen when we're able to master our emotions. Well, Russell Friedman arrived at the Grief Recovery Institute in 1986 on the heels of a second divorce and a bankruptcy. And I do know how that feels, Russell. After dealing with the emotions caused by those and other losses, he started a rigorous training under the guidance of the Institute founder, John W. James, eventually becoming a partner and co-author of three books, The Grief Recovery Handbook, When Children Grieve, and Moving On. Today, we're talking about the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. Together, Russell and John co-developed the Grief Recovery Method Support Group, and that's helped more than 500,000 people around the U.S. and abroad. Russell's also become the go-to grief recovery expert on CNN, appearing many times, most notably in the wake of 9/11 and also following the death of Michael Jackson. And when we have our national tragedies, unfortunately, Russell also helps with that, most recently appearing on the Today Show. So he's a guest lecturer at local academic institutions. He's consulted with major companies that are learning that unresolved loss has a negative impact in the workplace. And he's executive director now of the Grief Recovery Institute, which you can visit at GriefRecoveryMethod.com. Russell Friedman, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you. This Russell Friedman sounds like quite a fellow. I would like to meet him myself.
Well, let me see what I
can do. But no, thank you for all that. I mean, that's 28 years of stuff, and something exciting for me to share with you and your audience. I arrive here every day for 28 years. Excited to be here. And yet the topic we're dealing with is grief, dealing with death, divorce, pet loss, and 40 other losses. And people ask me, isn't it depressing doing what you do, talking about grief, talking with grievers? And my answer is no. It is uplifting because, and I'm sure you know this, Eileen, from what you've done and do all these years, that when I talk to someone, there is a very, very, very high probability that when the conversation is over, they will feel different than they felt when it started because they call me very low, very heavy, very desperate. And as a result of what I can just communicate with them and how I can hear them emotionally differently than other people do, there's something uplifting. So I arrive here excited. I leave here tired, but so beautifully elevated by feeling good about what I'm able to do. It's a kind of a gift. I never would have known that I could do this. I was in the restaurant business most of my adult life, and yet I got here by accident 30 years ago, and I've been, I guess, blessed with the ability to want to and be able to help grieving people. And you know what? As I'm sure you know, I'm the big winner. Every day I get to feel good about me and what I do and the connection and bond with others, which is what helps me understand the disconnection, the broken bond, whether it's with a pet or a human or any other kind of loss. So, you know, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
Oh, yes. Well, I certainly know what you're talking about. You know, I go in to see my therapy clients and they're down, but it's so wonderful that you can, you know, early in my work, I used to say, you know how your friends come to you and they talk to you about what's going on in their lives? Well, I actually have things I can say to them that make them feel better. It's really wonderful.
So, yes. Yeah. And that they trust us to do that. And then as we are trustworthy back with them, it develops its own little relationship of value. So, you know, I can't imagine at this point doing other things in my life. Other things are valuable, not to dismiss anything, but this has been heartwarming for me.
Yeah. You started out in grief recovery for human beings. How did you get into the grief recovery for pet loss business?
Well, it's interesting. It's true, but not really, what you just said. If you go back to the original book that John W. James wrote all by himself and self-published more than 30 years ago, the foundation emotional event for him chronicling his young life was when he was about 7, his dog Peggy died, and he was crushed as a 7-year-old can be. By the way, male or female, it doesn't matter. Gender is not the issue in grief. He was devastated. His parents said to him, quote, "Don't feel bad. On Saturday, we'll get you a new dog." But John, at age 7, first of all, he felt bad because his soulmate, if you will, his most trusted being on the planet was his dog, Peggy. John was growing up in an alcoholic household. The dad was a raging, violent drunk, and the mom was what you would call an untreated Al-Anon. It was mayhem, and his older brother was at war with his father. The only safe entity, the only safe place for John was Peggy. And when Peggy died, John was totally lost, totally alone. And his parents say, "Don't feel bad." And he's 7. He felt bad, as you would at 17 or 77. You feel bad when someone you love dies. And they said, "On Saturday, we'll get you a new dog." And they went out Saturday and got him a new dog. But if you meet John and ask him the name of that second dog, he can't tell you. He instinctively or somehow knew he did not want to bond with that new dog and get his heart broken again, although he probably couldn't have languaged it like that. He just instinctively pulled away, and he gave that dog to his younger brother. And so the idea of replace the loss, just go get another dog, didn't work for John right out of the gate. And it may ultimately have been a large part of why he eventually created the Grief Recovery Institute and wrote the Grief Recovery Handbook when he had a 3-day-old baby son die in 1977. But the foundation of everything we do here harkens all the way back to the death of John's dog in, let's see, he was born in 44 in 1951. So while our Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss is new, just came out a year ago, it is not a new topic for us. In fact, it's, as you know, it's blended in with all the other losses we all experience. So it's just an extension of what we do, and we pulled out the pet loss to write a unique separate book about it because in our culture, sadly, people don't allow grieving pet owners to grieve. They dismiss them completely, and I'm sure we'll talk about it because it's the opening of the book. But, you know, just as a backdrop, pet loss is not really new for us, although it seems to be.
Thank you for that explanation. And as you were talking, I recalled that we actually did a program, I think, last year on children and animals. It was a university professor who had been studying this topic for some time, and young children, like John when he was 7, don't differentiate. They don't think that animals are any different than humans in terms of importance and need for respect and so forth. So
I agree. In fact, I'm right involved, even as we speak, with socializing my 2-year-old granddaughter who lives with us and our 2 dogs. And I'm watching those relationships between the dogs and the baby and the baby and the dogs, with everything you just said. And I couldn't agree more, because I have a name or a title. I'm Papa, and there's Grandma, and there's her friends. But the dogs have names, so I can see that what you and the professor said is absolutely true. They don't differentiate. It's a being with a name. Therefore, it's part of my life. Therefore, there's a kind of a bond. I agree with that. I'd never heard it put that way before, but I agree with it 100%.
Yes, I loved reading that because, you know, they said, oh, no, you must respect these animals, especially children 7 and under, you know, right where you're talking about. So what I read as I was preparing for the show is that here in the U.S., we've got about 40 million new grievers every year because their pets die, and yet we, as a culture, we don't talk about death, we don't face death, we don't allow ourselves to grieve. I think just last week I was talking with someone whose husband died, and she's already being pressured after just 8 months to get over it. And I said, no, you get to go as long as you want to. It's your grieving, not anybody else's.
Exactly. I mean, as you know, there's a famous cliche that happens to be true, which is everyone grieves in their own way and at their own pace. And while that's a truthful statement, it doesn't have huge meaning outside of its, the simpleness of it. The real issue isn't grief. The real issue is recovery. And that's where the trap is. Everyone grieves. Everyone grieves differently. But grief is not the goal. The goal is recovery. How do I discover and complete what the death or divorce or any other loss left emotionally incomplete for me? And then after discovering what is unfinished for me, how do I complete it so that indeed I can move forward? I can have a life of meaning and value, even though my life is radically sometimes or dramatically changed by the absence of that person, that dog, that job, the career, whatever it is, even if it's loss of faith in God or God's local representatives or whatever. So the real issue is to move away from talking only about grief to really talking mainly about recovery. Yes, this is true. Yes, my heart is broken. Now, what do I do about it so that I don't live as a permanent victim of the loss? And as something I think you said in the opening, so that we can have, you didn't say it this way, this is the way we say it, paraphrasing you, so you can have fond memories not turn painful, okay? So you can remember the pet or the human the way you knew them in life, not only as you knew them in death. And those are part of the objectives of grief recovery, to help people. You know, people say you have to let go and move on, and we go, great poetry, but what does that mean? Let go of what and move on to where? My mom died suddenly, tragically, the day before Thanksgiving 22 years ago in 1993. And if you say, well, you have to let go, and I'm going to go, how dare you? You want me to let go of my fond, sweet memories of my mother? I don't want to do it. And even if I wanted to, how would you do that? How do you let go of memory? And then, you know, Eileen, until or unless I get Alzheimer's, I am not going to forget my mother. I'm not going to forget my dog who died. I'm not going to forget friends. I'm not going to forget much of anything other than unimportant stuff. And so it's really important for us at Grief Recovery, and I'm sure you agree with much of what I'm saying, and to start to change people's language, starting with the children, because what we learn when we're a child, we take through life. In a crisis, we'll go back to old beliefs and old behaviors. Sometimes we'll go back to beliefs we don't even know we have because they were planted in us prior to the dawn of conscious memory, which is usually around age 3 or 4. And so it's real important to be conscious of what we're teaching our children when it comes to the topic of grief.
I totally agree with you. Interestingly, yesterday I was having a conversation with a young man who's in his late teens. He had been quite anxious as a young child, and we were talking about anxiety. And I told him the story of my son, who at age 4 was attacked by a dog and had a deep cut right under his eye, had to have stitches. But it happened under circumstances, and I explained it to my son. I said that, you know, the dog is not upset with you. You had a plate with food on it, and you're at the right height so that your eyes were looking straight into his eyes, and dogs attack when that goes on. So this was a dog behaving like a dog. And my son actually was able to go back and forgive the dog. So
fabulous.
To the extent that the following year we were given the opportunity when he was 5 to foster a dog who bit small children, and we were successful in dealing with the dog, and mostly my son was the one who got the dog to realize that we loved her and there was no need for her to be vicious.
And as I listened to that story, you know what? I wrote myself a little note. Your son had an excellent teacher, and I'm talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
It's very important. By the way, we had a parallel event yesterday in my home where the little two-year-old got in the big dog's face, and she just was, you know, as kids can be, a little unrelenting. And the dog just kind of give her a little warning to her hand, her arm. Didn't break skin or anything, but he was going, excuse me, young lady, you can't do that. And she came over, whatever. And we said, yes, you got too close. You know, you have to respect his space. You can't, you wouldn't like it if someone came and got in your face that way. And she said, oh. And so she went over and she hugged him. It was amazing. She went right over and hugged him.
Yes.
And he was just, he just melted. You know, he loves her, but she had crossed the line. And so she's learning about the lines.
Right, right. And so my point in talking with this young man yesterday is it to talk about the starting with the child and the language that we use is that how you relate to traumatic events depends on, as a child, depends on how your caretakers, your parents, focus your attention. You know, when you lose your pet, you can focus on, well, we'll replace it, or you can focus on, that's really a loss. I know that was your best friend. Come here, let me give you a hug. You know, it depends on where we focus children, doesn't it?
Oh, you know what? From your mouth to God's ears, I could not agree more. And let's go a step further, or in the same church, different pew. Our little Zoe, who just turned two last week, from her earliest ability to crawl and walk and fall down, I had learned this, and I taught my spouse and my stepdaughter, who's the mommy of the baby, I taught them not to gasp when the baby falls. Let's see what the baby indicates. Okay, and she's two now. She's not a baby. She's a big little girl. She can run and tumble and whatever. She falls all the time. She hardly ever cries. She usually gives herself a kind of a quick exam and goes, fine. And doesn't even, just gets up and keeps going, does not complain. Because we don't give that gasp, oh my gosh, are you okay? We don't create any of that kind of quote-unquote anxiety relating to what you're talking about. So this little girl's really helping. If she's hurt, she will cry and let you know. And then, of course, she believes that the cure for everything is ice. She'll just go boo-boo and run to the freezer and say, you know, so we have these little ice packs, because she thinks ice is the answer to the world. And she may be right, I don't know. But she has not been conditioned to be a victim of the events. She kind of, without being analytical, she kind of figures out if she's really hurt or just a temporary thing and moves through it. I love that. I wish all parents would learn not to gasp. I think the gasp sets up a false attention and ultimately does not play out well for most. I'm sure you've seen that in your therapy practice, where aspects of that, you could probably speak to it much better than I could.
Well, we actually trained our son, same son, the same way when he was young. But we used behaviorist, we used to call it rat psychology, where it has to do with reinforcement. And we would not move to do anything for our son for the first 10 seconds after he had fallen, and allowing him to get up instead to take care of himself. And it's really wonderful. And the same, you know, it's really just great that you are talking about supporting children in reacting in competent ways to their environment. And I think that's what you're talking about, not only for children, but for people who are grieving the loss of their pet.
Right. And now watch by extension how we do with Zoe. And this is something I've been teaching for years. It's in our book, When Children Grieve and Everything, is that when she cries, no one in our home, and I have gone to her schools, the preschools, to lecture their teachers, her teachers.
Good.
When Zoe cries, no one ever tells her, don't feel bad. Because don't feel bad is the first, most classic, most dangerous myth we all learn in childhood that limits us when it comes to dealing with grief. Now, why shouldn't you feel bad or sad if someone you love dies? Why shouldn't, if you get hurt, why shouldn't you feel sad? If you feel someone has hurt your feelings. Why shouldn't you feel sad? It makes no sense. It's like this. Let's say one day you call me, say, hi, Russell, it's Eileen. I say, hi, how are you doing? You say, I'm doing great. Things are great at work. Things are great at home. I'm just really enjoying myself. Would I go, don't feel good? I mean, doesn't it sound stupid?
Yes.
And yet, if you call someone and say your favorite aunt died, the first thing out of their mouth is going to be, don't feel bad, she's in a better place. Now, but you do feel bad. That's why you're saying it. And she may or may not be in a better place. Let's hope she is, but you aren't. The griever is rarely in a better place when there's been a death or a divorce or whatever. So we're socializing young Zoe that when she cries, say, oh, you're sad? Okay. And now as she's getting language, say, can you put words, do you know what made you sad? And sometimes she doesn't, and we don't push it, because pushing it causes them to have a reason. And let's face it, you or I, as adults, can be sad and not know why. You can be happy and not know. Why are you so happy, Eileen? I don't know. I just felt that way. You don't have to have a reason. So we're eliminating what we think are the roadblocks to emotional truth and allowing her to communicate her feelings in the moment she has them. And the miracle, it's not even a miracle, I believe it's just a byproduct. She processes feelings very quickly. She can move from sad back to neutral or happy very, very quickly, because like with the falling down, she gets to be the determiner of what it is. No one from the outside is telling her out of how she feels or pushing her in any particular direction. And I hope and suspect you would agree with this idea based on, you know, me just, you and I just meeting today, but I'm really enjoying this. It's not our typical interview on this book, but we'll get to that because this stuff's real important too.
Well, it really is. And just for me to emphasize a bit, you know, I'm known as the emotional pro. I end up talking about emotions all the time. And we're in such agreement that emotions are energy. And you've got to, you know, the way that you deal with emotions is to move that energy, not block it up.
Allow it and give it a proper airing so that it can have been done. I mean, it's kind of like the weather in the Midwest. You don't like the weather, wait a minute. But feelings are like the weather. They are constantly moving through, and they're inconstant. You don't stay happy or stay sad. There's constant stimuli that change our reaction, and the feelings are, and when you watch babies, you see that. Then later we try to freeze people into a feeling, which is not an emotionally helpful thing to do. It doesn't allow the normal flow. Even within this conversation, you and I will have emotions, internal emotions that relate to what we're saying, to our own relationship to the topic, to things we've seen, to our children or grandchildren, which have become quite thematic in our chat, which I love because you and I are the product of all of our experiences. And what I love is, you know, if we're not getting too arcane here, that the listeners will be learning something and go, oh, I never thought of it that way. Oh, that's a good one. I want to do that with my kids or my grandkids. So if we can share that, it's another great day in the neighborhood.
That's great. Well, what's also important, now when you were talking about recovery, recovery, like you said, is air the emotions first, and then what you want to do is to let the energy move and move on out of you and be done with it. But what we normally do, as you talk about in your book, is we involve ourselves with short-term energy relief behaviors, what you call STERBS, STERBS, which are such things as food, alcohol, anger, exercise, fantasy, isolating, sex, shopping, and workaholism. So in other words, if we don't allow this energy of our grief to move, we generally turn to things that mask the emotion, that we don't have to look at it, but which are not necessarily beneficial to us. Is that correct?
You are absolutely correct. And let me kind of define short-term energy-relieving behaviors have a certain value, but it's a limited value because they're short-term. It's like, let's say you and I are friends, and one night we have an argument, and I go home from Europe, place to mine, and I'm really mad at you, and I know you're mad at me, and with the energy I'm creating in myself, being angry with what you said or did, okay, I go home and I eat a gallon of Rocky Road ice cream. Now, in a short-term way, it would be soothing. Ice cream is comfort food, or I could go eat a pizza. There's certain foods that kind of qualify as comfort food. But the question is, have I done anything at all in any way to affect my feelings about angry at you and maybe my reaction? Have I done anything? And the answer is no. And I may be creating a long-term problem for myself with an eating disorder or some other abuse of substances of some sort or activities of one kind or another. So the illusion of well-being when I eat the ice cream or drink the cocktails or whatever it might be, is that just an illusion? It doesn't give any long-term completion. And if you watch how this starts, we all learn this very young. So imagine this, a little girl or a boy, let's say a little girl has come home from preschool and she has tears in her eyes. And the mommy or daddy or grandma or grandpa very correctly says, "What happened, honey?" And the child, trusting their caregiver, tells the truth. And she says, "The other little girls were mean to me." Mm. At which point, the guardian makes a colossal error and plants a lifetime problem. And the caretaker says, quote, "Don't feel bad, honey. Here, have a cookie. You'll feel better." Now, here's the question. Does the cookie make the child feel better, or does the cookie make the child feel different? And there's only one correct answer. Different. It does not make the child feel better. It distracts them from the original problem. Now, the original problem of the behavior of the other kids and what happened gets tucked away in the child's little body where, yes, and we don't even have to be woo-woo here, it can create energy because it's not dealt with and it's still living in the body. And the body is not supposed to be a container. It's a processing plant for feelings, not a container. When you use your body as a container, nothing good can happen. There will be explosions or implosions, whether you're adult or child, they'll call it acting out, but what it is a byproduct of not processing feelings correctly, because when you're little, you're told don't feel bad when you do. Now, let's take it 10 years out. This little girl is now a teenager, had her first boyfriend, and he broke up with her. She's devastated. She mopes across the playground, and someone goes, "Psst, psst, hey girl, come here. Try this, you'll feel better." And they hand her a beer or a joint or something else. Now, where did she learn to use substances to modify her feelings? From her home parents or grandparents who said, "Don't feel bad, here, have a cookie." So the indirect, incorrect use of substances to modify feelings is the foundation problem with grief. The minute you tell a child, "Don't feel bad," you're telling them, "Don't be honest." And as I said, with our little Zoe, when she says she cries, we say, "Oh, you feel sad? Oh, okay. Can you say what it is?" And before she could talk, we didn't say, "Couldn't you say?" We just said, "It's okay. Crying's okay. Laughing's okay." And so the foundation for everything grief-related is the idea of don't feel bad, followed by replace the loss. We remember we talked about it earlier. You get your dog die. When John's dog died, his parents said, "I'll get you a new dog." And when you're a teenager and your boyfriend or girlfriend breaks up with you, and your mommy or daddy will say, "Don't feel bad, there are plenty of fish in the sea," which is the first time you knew you were dating a fish, but the message from your own guardian is, go get another boyfriend or girlfriend, replace the loss, just like we'll get you a new dog. But they don't get taught how to grieve and complete their unique, one-of-a-kind relationship with the boy or girl they were going with, and they stuff the unfinished business of that incomplete relationship down in their body. And then when they start their next relationship at their parents' insistence, okay, they hold back their heart, they hold back their truth, because they're afraid to get hurt again. And in so doing, they sabotage the relationship. Now, you know, as a pro and just as a human being, that the divorce rate in our culture is 50% for first marriages. And I suspect as a professional, you also know that second marriages fail at a rate of 64%. And third marriages fail at a rate of 70%, which means replace the loss doesn't work. Okay, when you get a divorce, you don't become good at marriage. When you get a divorce, you get good at divorce. And so you can do it again and again. It doesn't teach you the lessons that you might need to learn to help you get complete with your former spouse so that you could present a new, more present self to your next spouse. And at the same time you're doing that, the new spouses have probably have had breakups too. And we bring a litany of unresolved and incomplete romantic relationships to our new ones, almost guaranteeing the new ones are going to fail. And so all of this is so linear, Eileen. It's just everything follows. Look, we teach our children to read and write and do math so they will succeed in life, so they will do well, so they will have tools. Especially if we should die, we want them well equipped for life. And yet grief is the most normal recurring event in life. Grief happens all the time, all kinds of losses. And yet we don't give our children effective tools, abilities, or knowledge for dealing with grief.
That was wonderful.
Thanks. I just made it all up, but it's all true.
It just you just keep rolling into the areas that I think are really, really important. And I was in my mind thinking, okay, now applying this to animals that we lose, you also are suggesting that we can't fully bond with a new pet. We're not fully open to bonding with a new pet, which I'm thinking about if we haven't finished our grieving. But we need to take a break right now, Russell. I'm talking with Russell Friedman. He's co-author of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, and it guides you step by step to finish the grief we all feel when we lose a pet that we love. We're going to find out how to create a relationship graph and use it to complete your grief recovery so you're free to talk lovingly about your pet without breaking down when we come back. You're listening to Full Power Living. Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Please go to EmotionalPro.com and click the subscribe button on the left-hand side. That will allow us to send you our twice-weekly newsletter advising you about our upcoming shows. Next week on Full Power Living, for example, Susan Shumsky will reveal how to awaken your third eye. That's Thursday, November 19th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern Time. My guest today is Russell Friedman, the go-to grief recovery expert on CNN. And listening to that ad that I created, I had this thought that I didn't have before, and that is, I see our Earth as a big giant school, and we have these experiences so that we can learn and progress. And it suddenly hit me that when a pet dies, it's offering, whether it intends to or not, I don't know, but it's offering us an opportunity to open up our emotional selves so that we can grow emotionally. Does that fit with your thinking?
100%, but, and this is a giant but, you and I have only talked about two of the six myths that we highlight in our books and our talks. We talked about don't feel bad and replace loss, but we didn't get to two of the most major ones that tie right into your question about this opportunity, potential opportunity to learn something, to grow and change and so on. And that is that almost all grieving pet owners isolate because in our society they are taught to isolate. on the first page of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, the opening chapter is entitled, Don't Feel Bad, It Was Only a ... And there you would put in dog, cat, bird, whatever your pet was. And the word only so minimizes your emotions, your feelings as a pet owner. And when we wrote that book, and when people read it, they go, oh, they realize the book is talking to them, because they have, by the time they get our book, it's weeks, days, weeks, or months since their pet died, and they've already heard it was only a dog hundreds of times, if not more. And it isolates them, because it's like, imagine if your mother died and someone said, don't feel bad, it was only a woman, or don't feel bad, it was only a mother. You would be almost righteously homicidal if someone said that to you. And yet someone said to you about the pet that you were bonded with, that you loved, that you trusted, that you had unconditional elements with, and says it was only a dog, that will automatically push you away. But you have already learned to isolate in our society. Almost everybody has, because we're all taught laugh and the whole world laughs with you, cry and you cry alone. So, and watch, if you're going to cry, Eileen, go to your room. Knock off that crying, or I'll give you a reason to cry. So by the time we get anywhere near adulthood, we've already been taught to withhold, isolate, remove our sad, painful, or negative emotions from the common area. In our society, by the age of 15, a child has received more than 23,000 inputs that suggest, A, don't feel bad, and if you do, please don't tell anybody about it. Oh, by the way, and while you're at it, don't burden others with your feelings, Eileen, if those feelings are sad, painful, or negative. It's okay to talk about your happy, not your sad. So grieving people isolate grieving pet owners even more than other grievers, because nobody understands. Their own friends and family do not understand the bond and the amount of emotional impact the death of a pet can have. I mean, I get calls from people all the time whose pet died, and they will tell me, without me provoking or causing them, will say they feel worse over the death of their pet than they did when their mother died, or their spouse, or their child. Now, do they really mean that? I don't know, and we don't compare losses ever, so I don't accept the comparison, because it's not valid or valuable. But what I do know is they are trying desperately to get someone to hear how bad they feel, rather than tell them, don't feel bad, just go get another pet. Now, that's just one myth, the grieve alone. The biggest other one is one that really comes up into the conversation we're starting about the opportunity to get some value from something sad or learn something. And that is the myth that time heals all wounds, or that grief just takes time. And I'm here to tell you that time can't heal your broken heart any more than time can fix a flat tire. It requires action to get your tire fixed, to get your car back on the road. The parallel is that an emotionally broken heart is remarkably like a flat tire, isn't it? The get up and go is got up and went. The ability to participate fully in life is limited. Grievers really do get stuck or paralyzed in their grief because of all these myths, don't feel bad, grieve alone, and so on. And time can't heal an emotional wound. And so the opportunity for learning, for growing, for changing, for expanding is delimited by all these myths that tell us not to feel that way in the first place and don't talk about them. So I would love to give an unlimited agreement with what you said, but I have to put an asterisk on, say yes if you can get past all the myths. So in our books and lectures, we always start with the myths, because you can't, if you believe time's going to heal you, you're not going to ask me for help. You're just going to sit and wait forever. And I'll bet, Eileen, you have known and seen with clients who have long-term, incomplete, unfinished grief things, and they've been waiting years and years and decades to feel better, but they haven't done anything to accomplish that, because they were taught, don't feel bad, time heals, and grieve alone. So my first job is re-educating people, taking these myths away, so they can do something realistic and helpful and valuable for themselves, including to respond to your beautiful, and I agreed, suggestion of the using the opportunity, the openness that the grief creates in your heart to do other things of value, to be able to carry the cherished memories forward, to be able to share the feeling of joy, to be able to choose to have other relationships even after one has ended through death or divorce. And, you know, but again, we got to do foundation work first. It can't start at the end. We always have to start at the beginning.
Well, I totally agree with you, and I think that's a really great idea to bring the myths out, because you do have to be willing. Perhaps because I work with helping people to open all the time, more tend to take that for granted. So thank you for that reminder. Now, one of the things that you do that I think is unique is you encourage people who've lost a pet to remember, actively remember things that they feel bad about with the pet, things they might be angry about, things they might feel guilty about. Talk about that for why you suggest
that. Let me just preamble that before we ask them to do that very, very powerful personal exercise, they do another powerful one, which is to list all of the pet losses they've had over their lifetime. Now, granted, some people get to our book and only had one pet loss, and it was recent. But many have, because most of our pets don't live as long as we do. A lot of people have had 10, 12, 15, 20 or more dogs or cats or other pets. And so we first have them list the losses they've had in the universe, because it's part of how they discover what they learn. And it's where they learn don't feel bad, don't share your feelings, and grieve alone. Because that helps them discard those false myths so that we can get to the truth of the work. Then the major work is to do what we call a relationship graph, and which is, as difficult as it sounds, it's the easiest thing in the world. It's just asking someone, think about your relationship with your pet. In my case, my dog Buddha, who was a Hungarian Vizsla, beautiful bird dog, is the dog, the story featured in the book. And if you scanned or read that section, it's quite detailed in my relationship with Buddha. And it's all the good things and bad things and a few ugly things. I mean, let's face it, as wonderful and perfect as dogs are, the dog will eat your shoes, the dog will have some separation anxiety and all kinds of things. Every once in a while, a dog will bite a child, sometimes without apparent reason. And so not every single thing that happens is glorious, wonderful, cuddly. So we ask you to graph out your relationship of everything that jumps into your mind and or heart, of things that happened and or didn't happen in your relationship with the pet who died. Dog, cat, horse, bird, it doesn't matter what it is, because there's still a relationship from your point of view. And in it, we sometimes discover some things that we need to forgive the dog for, or cat. We sometimes discover things we have to thank them for that we never verbally thank them. We sometimes find some things we have to apologize for. Sometimes we get a little snippy or cranky with our pets. We bark at them, even though we're not the barkers. We snap at them. And they're confused because they don't have the language skills that people do. And so some of our verbal and nonverbal behavior might confuse our dogs. Some of us are not really excellent leaders of a pack and don't know a lot about dog behavior. And so when you review the relationship, you discover some things. And here's the key language in all of grief recovery. There are inevitably things we wish had happened differently, better or more. And there's inevitably realized hopes, dreams, and expectations about the future. So I can boil grief recovery and the relationship graph down to six words: different, better, more, hopes, dreams, expectations. And I promise you, Eileen, in all relationships that we can have, whether with human or with animals, those six words are all we need to help people discover what is emotionally incomplete with them in their relationship to the entity that died, or their divorce, or any other loss. It actually makes, people say it sounds difficult, but the truth is it's very easy. Here's another little factoid that I suspect you already know. In the immediate aftermath, the first few days or weeks after the death of your pet or the death of your spouse or anyone else, you will never have keener, more accurate memories of your whole relationship with them. In fact, grieving people have a hard time concentrating or focusing. That's why work is difficult for people. School is difficult because their whole being is focused on, their heart and their head are focused on their relationship with the pet that died or the person who died. Okay, now that's why they can't pay attention to the weather or the baseball score. They're just letting their heart and head are on that relationship. And if they go to do grief recovery work, either with a helper or in a seminar or training or one of our workshops, or they do it themselves in the book and with a partner or without, they will never have an easier time remembering all the things that are important to them, good, bad, and sometimes ugly. So this relationship graph is actually easy to do once there's a proper stimulus to help them do it. The stimulus we use is, and if you notice in the book, we tell our story. When I tell my story in the book and you read it, what happens is your brain automatically goes to your story. It uses my story is a fulcrum for you to go, oh, no, that didn't happen with my dog. This did and that did. And you will be, as you read mine, you're doing your own without knowing it. So by the time we ask someone to actually put pen to paper and do the exercise, the truth is they've already done it. They just don't know it. They were doing themselves while I was doing me. And even if you when they listen to me in a seminar do it, they're copying me, but for them, not me. And so it's a very simple process where our going first sets the table for them to follow suit. We don't believe in intervention when it comes to grief. You must have a willing participant or you don't have one, because it's all predicated on doing what is truthful for you in your memories. No phony or false stuff. You can't get complete with a lie, only with the truth. So this process of creating a graph exposes to us things that we know that might have been tucked away or we haven't thought of much lately, and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that is the kind of prelude to what we would in the discovery process to move towards a completion, where we then take the elements of the graph and put them in three very simple categories: apologies, forgiveness, and significant emotional statements. And a significant emotional statement is simply something that's important to us, has emotional meaning or value to us in relationship to the pet who died. And when you read my relationship with Buddha is rather elaborate, has a lot of things, including just a heartbreaking absence. One of the things I had always wanted to do, my dog was a hunting dog, a runner. It looked like an Olympic athlete watching him run. And I'd always wanted to take him to the beach, to watch him run at the beach. And I just never got around to it. And sadly, he died, and it had never happened. And it's a big part of my letter. Now, my new dog, Baxter, who is now 11 years old, for years, almost every weekend, he and I went to the beach. It was one of the very first things I did with him after I got him. Although it was not replace the loss, I was darned if I was going to let myself not do something or be lazy. And of course, he thinks the beach is his backyard. I mean, he has entertained thousands and thousands of people at the beach with his running and his stalking of birds, which he never catches. I know he dreams about flying. If he could only fly, he could catch them.
That's great. Well, I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, Russell, that it would be great for pet owners to get your book on grief recovery for pet loss while their pet is still alive and go over those sections, because how great it would be to apologize to our dog, cat, or spouse even, apologize to them, forgive them, and tell them what they mean to us before they're gone. That would be very helpful.
Absolutely. Actually, all of our books, particularly those two, the Grief Recovery Handbook, Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, and When Children Grieve, are basically primers. They're primers for emotional truth. they immediately debunk the six myths, which then allows the truth. Everything you and I are talking about is in those six myths. The things we want to do better with the children in our care is right there. And what it teaches us to do, emotionally speaking, is to live in the moment, in present time. And that is not a woo-woo concept. That is a, I think it's a command in the universe if we recognize how valuable it is to not process our feelings in the moment we have them is not good for us. And that's what the beauty is, you know, with me socializing the two-year-old. I'm actually learning from her one more time. She processes every feeling in the moment she has it. She doesn't store them away. She has been given the privilege of communicating however she can in the moment. And then she moves to the next moment, really done with the last one.
Yeah.
And it's a valuable life lesson. Now, we can't live exactly the way a two-year-old does, and we don't want to become a squalling infant. But the lessons from the child and the lessons from the dog or cat, animals live in the moment better than people because their brains don't work in the way our do about storing certain kinds of things. Yes, they have a few little fears and phobias, yes, 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 but in the main, they live in the moment, from moment to moment. In fact, they talk about in training dogs that you can't, their span of remembering things is very short when you're doing training stuff, so you really have to do it right away with a clicker or whatever. And so, but I think the goal in life, from every spiritual, emotional, academic, intellectual point of view, is to live effectively in the moment. You know, and I have a personal comment about that. When I arrived here at the Grief Recovery Institute 28 years ago, as you mentioned, on the heels of my second divorce and a bankruptcy for $500,000, I was as unhappy as I knew how to be. I didn't, the depths to which my life had sunk were, you know, almost unlanguageable, just that horrible. I wasn't suicidal, blessedly, I think, but I was just miserable. That point in time, Eileen, I would have traded my existence for anyone on planet Earth. That's how uncomfortable I was in my heart, my soul, my skin. Mm-hmm. And today, 28 years later, I would not trade with anyone. Now, that's not an arrogant statement. Doesn't mean I'm perfect. It means I am living as best I can in my body, in my heart, in the moment, in real time, communicating the truth without being hurtful to others as best as humanly possible. And one thing happens is that I go to, evidently my spouse says, when I put my head down, she says, 10 seconds later, you're asleep. I don't know how you do it. She's very envious of that. And then I wake up in the morning feeling refreshed. And I only sleep maybe 6 hours or so. So I believe my ability to process feelings in the moment that they're having enhances my ability to live life in the moment as it happens. Because I'm not ganging stuff up and tucking it away inside where it's going to haunt me later.
Just in terms of personal, I too sleep about 6 hours a night, put my head on the pillow, and wake up refreshed the next morning. And I'm celebrating my 73rd birthday in 2 weeks. And traditionally, people of my age have difficulty sleeping. And I have the same theory, Russell, that it's because I handle the emotions as they come up. I don't have anything that keeps me up at night worrying if I don't worry. I don't feel guilty. I'm complete. And if I have a problem to solve, I ask for help during the night, and I wake up the next morning with the answer. So it's pretty
cool.
Yeah,
I love that. Me too. And you know who I will sometimes ask for help?
Who?
My mother, who died 22 years ago, because she was my font. She was my source. She was my safety. She protected me from my dad, blah, blah, blah. And I can ask my mother, in my head, ask my mother a question and just wait and know that I will get the answer because I will know exactly what she would have said to guide me. How that works, I can't quite explain and nobody's asking, but I love it. I just use it and I trust that I kind of set up the question, go to sleep and wake up and it has become clear. And I know, you know, nothing woo-woo. It's not, I'm not communicating with mom in any direct way, nothing magical, just my memory as a source of the kind of language and guidance and thinking she would use to help me. So, by the way, young lady, you are now my big sister. Because I will be 73 in January, so you have to be big sister now.
Okay.
And you better be a good big sister.
My son tells me that I'm the family elder now, and there are lots of things incumbent with that. Well, have a happy birthday when it comes. You know, sadly, Russell,
you
I've
too.
Really I've really enjoyed this. We're going to have to wind this down. Maybe we can have you come back and we can talk more on some of these particular issues. I mean, I would love to do an entire program on working with children in grief, so that would be something I would love to do with you.
I'd be honored. By the way, one quick line from our book, When Children Grieve, we use this analogy. We say, would you take scuba diving lessons from someone who has never scuba dived? And of course, the answer is no. So we want the parents to become more aware and knowledgeable of grief and grief recovery and things, because how are you going to teach them something you haven't done or don't know how to do? So we'll have a great hour on the children. It's obviously a topic very, very, very close to my heart.
Great, great. Well, I'm really grateful to you and to your co-authors for writing this handbook, and I did read it. That's one of the things I do for the show. And as you have so clearly picked up as a person who's worked with emotions for many years, I totally agree with the way that you are working with emotions. And what I particularly like that you've done in your book is that you've given a simple structure for moving through emotions that can be used not only with pets, but with anything, that any creature, person that we are grieving. So thank you so much, Russell, for your work in helping us to grieve and recover. Remember, those of you who are listening, the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss is what we've been discussing, and the website is griefrecoverymethod.com. And I do agree that it's kind of like Dr. Spock's book on babies used to be. It's something that you would benefit from having in your home. Consider Christmas or Hanukkah presents of this book. I think it's really, really good and just stellar in terms of helping us deal with our emotions. So, Russell, thank you, and thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you, and giant hugs to you.
All right. So next week, listen to Full Power Living when I talk with Susan Shumsky about awakening your third eye. I look forward to having you with us then. That's November 19th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern Time. This show has been co-produced by Paul Johnson of Fresh Talk Media and me, your host. Thanks for helping me to expand my comfort zone, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.